What's up, everybody? Nick Sarnicola here, episode 24 by fire. Daniel D'Amico, we are in your home studio.
That's right.
Thank you for this.
You're very welcome.
These are your guitars.
These are my guitars.
We're going to circle back to that in just a quick moment. Let's tell everyone here what Forged by Fire is, why we do this. Quick backstory, I'm from Michigan originally, blue collar, you know, middle class upbringing, always wanted to be successful one day, didn't know how. Went on, played college baseball, got introduced to entrepreneurship at 18, fell in love, and went on that roller coaster for the last 25 years. Billions in sales, tens of millions of personal dollars spent or lost, reinvestments, earnings, country launches, failures, blockbuster products, products that sucked, you know, filling up arenas, lawsuits, like every peak and valley you could possibly imagine on a 2.5 decade journey of entrepreneurship. And Forged by Fire is not about the peaks, it's about the valleys, right? Where's the fire at, you know, not the good fire, but like the fire that where you want to give up, or maybe you're just like, you don't know what to do next, or maybe you want to quit. And that's where you're forged to become that person that you were really meant to be. That's the context. Episode 20, Daniel D'Amico, boop. Tell us your story. All right, where are you from?
So I'm from Long Island, New York. I started playing piano when I was 4 years old, started playing guitar when I was 13. So music was pretty much my life. It was always the thing I was the best at.
Just picked it up? What, mentor?
It's just one of those things, like the piano was around the house. I kind of gravitated towards it naturally. Parents noticed that. To this day, my parents have never told me to go practice the piano. Like, it was always something that I always just, you know, did myself. But it was always my thing. It was always like, you know, going through school, you know, I was just known as that guy. So through my childhood, you know, I always wanted to pursue music. I ended up studying at Berklee College of Music for 5 years in Boston.
Worldwide
famous music conservatory. That's when I realized that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. So
I had the same experience at college baseball.
You're the best in your hometown, and then you go to an institution where there's 5,000 other best people from their respective hometowns. So the best thing that ever could have happened to me was putting myself in an environment where I got my ass kicked and my ego checked, and that was the catalyst for me to kind of break through skill-wise.
Who were some of the, would we know any of the musicians that were in and around your timing there?
I mean, John Mayer is one that went to Berklee. Yeah. Berklee's had a lot of famous musicians, guys from Aerosmith, not during my time. They went to Berklee. You know, a lot of jazz greats went through there.
Probably a lot of traditional musicians.
Traditional musicians.
Orchestra, things like that. Am I making that shit up? Or?
No, I mean, it's like I said, it's a worldwide, you know, all different styles of music. From rock, jazz, fusion, you know, pop, classical. So that was, I would do it again. Like, I'm glad I took the route to go study at Berklee. But after Berklee, you know.
What did you learn the most at Berklee, do you think? You kind of referenced it something a second ago, but when you think about your key takeaway, yes, it was, I would do it all over again because I got my ass kicked and put my ego in check. But
it was the people I met, just standing outside the building. You know, just like, the people that I ended up meeting there and forming bands with, and, you know, I could trace everything that I've done in Los Angeles in my music career back to, you know, one or two people, one or two introductions, and everything spiderwebbed from there.
What an eclectic, like, group.
Like, I could literally, you know, every band that I've played with here, it all goes back to, like, one or two people that I met at Berklee. So it's networking.
When you go to Berklee and you play music, you actually taught me something today that you majored in something. Like, I'm like, oh, well, what do you mean you major? Like, you actually have a degree.
It's right here. Bachelor of Music.
Why is that not in your mom's fridge?
Yeah, I should give it to her, right? I majored in music production engineering, which is actually a very technical major. I mean, we had to take, like, science of acoustics and, you know, learn the ins and outs of recording consoles. So it's very nerdy major, like reading a lot of manuals. I spent more time in that than actually playing.
Yeah, which I didn't know. We've been friends for 10 years. I had no idea that you had a degree in something technical as opposed to instrumental. I don't know if that's the right way, but
well, I don't know why I didn't pursue performance, because then I just would have been playing the whole time. I guess I was like,
I need a job after this.
So funny you say that.
You're a very security-driven person, so that makes sense.
So the goal was to always move to LA after college, but at the back of my mind, I really just wanted to be a rock star. I just wanted to play fucking guitar on stage, tour all over the world, live in a tour bus, play rock music, you know, and how was I going to do that? I don't know, but I knew I had to get to LA. So, all right, I have this audio engineering degree. I could go work at recording studios.
Right.
So
it's almost like an athlete, right? So an athlete goes to school, gets a full ride scholarship. They want to be a professional football player, but they go get their blank degree in communications or degree in marketing, just in case they don't get drafted or don't make it.
Yeah.
They have that fallback degree.
Well, the timing of the music business and when I actually decide to go to school, it's the worst timing ever. It's when Napster started kicking in, so people started downloading music. And the advent of the home recording studio, like we have here,
you
could go out for $5,000 and buy all this shit. So a lot of recording studios started shutting down around the same time. So the music business was taking a pretty big dive right as I moved out here. But the day I moved to LA, this is like a very cliche story, but the day I moved to LA, like I moved into my apartment that I've never seen before. Like I rented it over the phone from Boston. And I'm like, shit, now what, I gotta get a job. So I got the Yellow Pages and I went out to the balcony and I opened up to recording studios. And I'm like, I'm just gonna start calling recording studios.
Kids don't know what we had to go through. Like when I was 20, 99, when I moved to San Diego, it's like, I didn't have a place.
Yeah.
And there was no fucking, you didn't go online and find places. And
no.
I packed up all my shit in a moving truck, moved to San Diego, and the shit sat in the truck until you found a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's like, you decided to find a place over the phone that you'd never seen before.
Never seen it.
I was like, I can do that, or I'm just going to go there homeless. I was homeless.
Yeah.
And it's like, the people don't register that are, let's say, 30 and younger, that's a real ass thing.
Yeah, had everything.
What's a phone book? What's a phone book?
Yeah, I was literally sitting on the balcony with the phone book. I was just calling. So I got two interviews that first day through the phone. I got two jobs, two really, really like prominent recording studios. Both were for runner positions. So I was like, all right, I'll go do the first day at each studio and kind of feel out the vibe. So the first studio I went to, I'm not going to name it, they were assholes. And they basically, you know, I was doing the same type of work. I was cleaning like the wheels of the recording machines when they're rolling down the hall. So like, you know, line up all the recording machines in the hallway and then like clean the wheels. And like, they'll give you like toothpicks and you gotta like clean in between the knobs and stuff like that.
Ugh.
Clean the bathrooms, go get the lunch, go get, you know, don't look at the artist in the eyes. That type of thing.
Don't look Kanye in the eyes.
Don't look any of the clients in the eyes when you're walking down the hall. Then I went to the other.
You're being serious.
Yes, 100%.
Really?
100%. So then I went to the second recording studio for the first day, and they were like, okay, here are your jobs. Here's what you need to do. You need to clean the bathrooms, clean the recording studios, vacuum, answer the phone, get the artists breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whatever they want. And, you know, whenever there's nobody using the studio or Studio B or Studio C, go in there. Go mess around. You have somebody you want to bring in, like, and record them?
Yeah. Nice.
So I was like, all right, this is a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So I was able to leverage that, the spare studio time, into networking with other musicians in LA. I'd call them up and be like, hey, you want some free recording time? I need some free practice. I need some practice time. And I was able to, like, start developing relationships like that. And one of the relationships that I developed through that was with a guitar player that ended up being the band The Calling that I joined. And my roommate at the time knew this guy. So it was kind of like the synergy of all these relationships started to come together. But I was able to spend time with him by having him come to the studio and like lay down some tracks. And
you said when had to audition, excuse me, for the band The Calling. How many guitar players were they auditioning?
I mean, it's a line around the block, so it's hundreds. Hundreds. You know, the band has had a lot of iteration, different iterations, but at that time, I had to go back. I mean, even though I knew the guys, I still had to audition. and go through that process.
So when you're in a real fucking band, it's not like, hey, call Charlie and see if he wants to join the band and we're going to be big. Like, this is like hundreds of people that you're competing for that one spot.
Yeah, because at the time, that band was very well established and famous and just about to release their second record and go into the world tour is slated, like you could see it, like next 18 months.
It's a real last thing.
Yeah.
So you're actually auditioning to be a part of a world tour as opposed to just like, you already know what you're signing up for.
Yeah. So when I got the gig, I've only been in LA probably 5 months at the time, which is really, really fast for that to happen. I didn't even have a passport. I had to get a passport rushed. And then I had to go quit the job at the studio, which was kind of like, I felt bad.
Yeah.
Because it was so cool to me, but they were like, we understand, like, you literally have to do this.
Well, for anyone under by 30, we have to create some context for the calling.
Right.
Because old guys like you and I, now that we're over 40.
I started auditioning for the calling when I was still in college. I remember I was making demo tapes and sending them, walking down to the post office in the manila envelope and like sending the CD of like a demo that I made. They probably never heard it. These guys probably still never heard it. But, you know, like I said, I made some connections at Berkeley where they knew the guys in the band directly. So, like, my name just started popping up more and more and more and more. I brought them into the recording studio when I was in L.A. And then when the spot came up for, like, the audition, I was like, all right, obviously I'm going to try out. But it doesn't mean you're automatically in. So I was still, like, in line.
Sure. You were networked, but you had to do the work. Like, it's fucking work. It wasn't like, you know, there's no, like, freebies.
Yeah, it was incredible when I got that gig because, it could be Monday, May 7th, I was cleaning a toilet, and then, like, Monday, May 20th, I was on stage in Sweden playing show number one.
Come on. All right, let's talk. So what level of recording artist was the calling? How many records? How many countries? You guys bigger internationally than locally or no? You had a number one song. And you're always modest about this shit because I always try to talk to you about this stuff.
So the calling was already established when I joined them. So they had one record out. They had a massive worldwide hit called Wherever You Will Go. That's how I knew about them. That's how everybody knew about them. Everybody knows that song if you play the first 10 seconds of it.
Which I try to do to you. Yeah. Anytime there's girls around, I try to play the song to make you embarrassed.
Works.
And the first key hits and you're like, you're looking at me like this.
We have to listen to this at a social gathering.
Yes, we do.
But yeah, I mean, at that point I was just, you know, just kind of like a hired gun. You know, I'm joining a well-established band. Everything's like lined up, tour is lined up, ready to go. So it wasn't late till later on that I started like getting closer with the singer, Alex, and we became very close friends. We started writing music together. That's when I really like, you know, hit my stride as far as songwriting. And I was, my dream was always to write my own songs or write songs with other people and perform something I wrote, you know, in front of large crowds and touring. But I remember like the
How first many countries.
I have no idea. 30, 40. But I remember just like
30, 40, whatever.
I loved the gypsy lifestyle, like living on the tour bus. Like I'm built for that shit. Like I'm a road dog. Like I love.
You were built for that shit. I can't even get you out to Miami, get you out of this.
No. So I mean,
condo that's life you got.
Yeah. At some point I was like, I just want to be in one spot for a minute. So,
what was your favorite country you ever played for?
Brazil is
okay.
Always a great time down
Rio?
There. Rio, Sao Paulo. The fans down there are just they're amazing. I mean, they have a lot of enthusiasm and love for the band.
How many people was the biggest crowd?
There's a photo on the wall over there. We played a festival called Party in the Park in London. That was about 180,000 people or something like that. You see it?
That one right there?
Yeah.
Bro, that looks like fucking Woodstock.
Yeah, it's just a sea of people. So you can make out people's faces for like the first three or four rows. Yeah, you can kind of make out like heads, and then it's just a sea of people.
What's like the high of the high? What's the feelings? What's the like? Give me the goods, man.
There's no feeling in the world like being on a stage playing rock music with a fucking guitar, loud guitar. Tens of thousands of people in front, like there's you know, It's better than anything you could possibly think of. For me, it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very unique feeling. Music's the only thing that gives me goosebumps. So, like, there's nothing else on the planet that gives me goosebumps, but I could be sitting in the car and a piece of music comes on and the hair on my arm stands up. I get goosebumps. It's the only thing in the world that does that. So,
which is me, it does it to non-musicians as well. Like, I could say the same thing. Like, there's certain songs that will always, you know, trigger. It's interesting how much we as people are tied emotionally, you know, to songs and to keys. And it's a universal language, right?
It is a universal language. I mean, when I went to Berkeley, you know, I was playing music with people that didn't speak a lick of English. Like, I couldn't have a conversation with you, but we could sit down across from each other and play music.
Very cool.
It's very cool.
Most exciting moment. Think of like what or something crazy. I want to hear something exciting, something crazy, something scary.
Something scary. So when we were playing in Brazil, we actually got held hostage by the Brazilian police after our show. We played in a city called Florianopolis, which is a little bit more inland.
Okay.
Brazil's not safe to begin with. So we come off the stage after our show, and our dressing room is kind of like in disarray, a little bit trashed. And then the police come in, and they said that we need to pay them $5,000, or they're not going to let us leave. And they pretty much, and they had like, you know, the full semi-automatics, and they were just out for a money grab. They pretty much held us hostage. So we had to get the promoter to come in, and he couldn't do anything. So we had to source $5,000 to get out of there, or the police were just not going to let us leave. So that was pretty terrifying. I remember being in the bathroom with my passport, trying to call like the passport, like the U.S. embassy or something. Yeah, because we weren't in the major city anymore. We drove like an hour inland. We were on dirt roads to get to this festival.
Jeez, I guess that's definitely scary.
That's scary.
What was the most fun moment, or one of, just look back at
that? Not necessarily with the calling, but like through my music career.
Sure.
You know, playing on like, you know, I played on Good Morning America a couple of times, which is it's completely live to like 80 million people.
Yeah.
So I played with an artist, Emmy Rossum, once, where it was just piano and her singing. And it was I was very exposed. There's no other musicians going on. There's no other notes going on except for me.
And her.
And her.
So if I fuck up, you can tell the difference between your fuck up and her fuck up.
If I fuck up, everyone's going to hear it. And there's no way to go back and edit it.
Yeah.
But the TV shows were fun. Like, I played Letterman. I played Leno a couple times. Good Morning America, American Idol. Those are always fun. And I always have, like, those videos to watch. And
craziest moment, wildest moment that you can share on this PG-13, what we swear, so are we rated R here? I don't know, are we PG-13? I don't know, something crazy.
I don't know, I mean, just like, you know, living that gypsy lifestyle and playing, like, we had one run, it was like 10 shows in a row, and just...
10 days, 10 shows, 10 countries?
So. Yeah, it was something like that, but it was just wake up, boom, right into the venue, sound check, you know, go to a meet and greet, play the show, get on a plane, go to the next city, boom, 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 boom. It's just like you're in it.
Yeah.
And it's just more of an overall, I don't think there's one like poignant, like crazy thing. Like getting held hostage is pretty fucking crazy.
I classify it as scary.
Fun
crazy, not like scary crazy. Circle back to it.
Yeah, I just think, you know, fun crazy. You know what really stands out to me was... one of the pieces that I wrote, one of the songs I wrote with Alex, the singer for the later record, we had an orchestra to play on half the record.
Right.
And we did it at Capitol Records. And I remember I was like, when I first moved to LA, I looked at Capitol Records, it was such like an iconic thing to me.
And I'm like,
now I'm fucking in Studio A Capitol Records as an orchestra. I'm holding the score in my hand. I still have it somewhere of a song that I wrote. The 60-piece orchestra playing it, and it was like a pinch yourself moment. That was fucking cool.
That's fucking badass.
Yeah.
Let's go America for a second. Favorite city in America to play for? Best fans in America?
That's a good one. mean, Chicago's great.
Okay.
New York is great. Portland.
Portland?
Yeah.
Worst city?
Minneapolis. Is that where you're from?
I'm from Grand Rapids. We're connected somehow through the north, through the Upper Peninsula. How about, we talk about best country, worst country to play for? Just no energy, dead. Or lower energy.
That's a tough one. Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's the worst, but when we played in Asia,
yeah,
the crowd just stands there,
yeah,
and looks at you,
yeah,
and then like you're playing a full balls to wall rock show, and like, the song ends, and
like, you're like jamming,
and
like,
and they'll just be like,
yeah, okay, that's what I mean, okay.
But culturally, it was one of the best experiences. Okay. Like traveling there was really the furthest departure from any other place in the world that I've ever been.
Like Japan, Tokyo,
yeah, Tokyo, Osaka,
Taiwan.
Yeah, that's
Hong Kong.
No, we went to
Singapore.
We went to Singapore. Okay. We actually, one crazy experience is we had the Prince of Brunei.
Okay.
Fly me and the singer out, first class, to play three songs acoustic for his birthday. And stayed there for 2 days, and then flew back, paid us an absurd amount of money to do it. That was a trip.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that shit's great.
I'm sorry. I was going to get going.
Yeah, we're going to dig back into these stories. We're going to dust them off.
The crazy... now I remember another one. So I was playing with David Cook. I was David Cook's guitar player and like music director. He won American Idol.
Yeah.
Years ago.
We co-sponsored one of the tours.
Yeah, exactly. The Neon Energy Drink.
Yeah.
We did a lot of... we worked together on that.
We were on that together.
So now it's coming back to me. So we did a lot of military tours. Military base tours.
Okay.
And one of the tours involves us playing on Memorial Day on a warship in the middle of the Persian Gulf, a full-on rock show on the jet.
That's
the jetway.
Badass.
So to get there, we had to fly into Ethiopia.
Okay.
Then they fly us from Ethiopia to Iraq.
Okay.
Then from the ground on Iraq, they fly us
on an aircraft carrier.
They take off from Iraq and they land us on the fucking aircraft carrier.
On like a jet? Oh, that's not like
on a plane.
Like how big?
I mean, it's not huge, but it's like a propeller plane.
And I got you. Okay.
So we land in the middle of the Persian Gulf. On like the USS Roosevelt.
How tired are you?
Pretty tired. We slept there overnight on the ship, woke up the next day, played a full-on rock concert on the jetway on Memorial Day, took a helicopter off of that, flew to the nuclear war sub that was also in the Persian Gulf, played another acoustic set on the nuclear sub.
Like underwater or?
No, it came up. It was like...
Okay, but you...
It was a nuclear... Sorry, not a sub, but it was a nuclear... It was like their where they have all the nukes or whatever. Different ship.
Okay. Above? But are you on top or are you in the ship? Like
I'm in the ship.
Yeah, you're in the ship. That's a sub.
Then they fly us the helicopter back to the main aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
And then they shotgun us off of that back to our... I mean, this is... I'm firing machine guns off the side, like fucking into the ocean. That's something that... Most people never get to
do. Did you see Iceman or Maverick? Or
Maverick was Maverick. He was poking around. That's a crazy experience that I had thanks to music.
Other fun musicians that you interacted with that you're like, wow, these guys are awesome. Just great to either play with or interact with. I'll take it easy. I won't go the other direction of that you didn't like, unless you're just like, I really want to tell you about this asshole. Who's somebody that you're like, or a couple of people you just loved interacting with or playing with?
I enjoyed playing with David Cook, because he's professional, but yeah. His voice, he was just always had the perfect pitch. Like he just was always right on.
Yeah.
So I got really spoiled with that. And, you know, good songs, good songwriter. I had a lot of fun playing with him.
Other bands.
I'm thinking who we toured with.
Yeah, people you either that open for you open for them, or maybe you just cross paths with and you just hang out.
We did a tour opening for John Mayer in Australia. That was really dope.
That's fun.
Yeah, and got to spend some time with him and chat it up a little bit and have a couple drinks and whatnot. And that was a memorable tour. And I don't know. I think a lot of this is it's coming back to me as we're talking about
it. Yeah, this is a decade ago.
Yeah.
Or longer.
Yeah.
John Mayer, he slays, doesn't he?
Yeah. In multiple ways. Cheers to that.
Cheers to that. All right. What would you consider to be, well, actually, you already told me, the 180,000 person festival? Would you consider that to be like the fucking peak?
No, because that was so early on.
Okay.
That was that first month that I, after I got the gig, and I was like,
is this normal?
It was, like I said, it was literally cleaning toilets to that within 3 weeks.
Insane, like, man.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that I went from, I mean, I was in college bands and high school bands where I'm lugging my fucking gear and we're putting it in the cars and we're, you know, dragging it to the rehearsal spaces in the cold Boston winters. And so I definitely paid my dues,
yeah,
like grinding it out. So, but then I went, you know, then I got the taste of like flying everywhere, your own hotel rooms, you have people setting up all your gear, doing everything for you, telling you where to eat, when to eat. You know, getting paid for all this, driving you everywhere, living on a tour bus, you know, like that. So, like, maybe I skipped a couple of middle levels, but throughout my career, I've gone back, and I've had to go back to like doing the van tours or doing like the RV tours and sharing rooms, and then got back to the, you know, the A level a couple times, and like, so there's been peaks and valleys and all
just like
that.
A business.
Just like all that.
Right. So getting to know you and getting to know your story, you know, is very similar to the journey of an entrepreneur, right? And just like the ups and the downs of it. And so let's go to where you, I mean, as a musician, it's unique because it's different than an athlete. You'll always, if you want to, be able to participate in music in one way, shape, or form, right?
Till I die.
And, like, when an athlete's done, they're done. You know, mm-hmm. It's just like, that's the end of it.
Unless you coach or...
Yeah, yeah, good point, yeah. Good point, unless you coach. But, you know, as a musician, if you want to do it, if you're still sharp enough, if you want to be, I mean, shit, how old are the Stones right now? 85,000 years old? Like, yeah. Dinosaurs? Like, 72, 73, 75? And
They're up pushing 80.
Yeah, like, yeah. So it's a little bit different in that regard. You know, there's if you haven't hit it out of the park financially, there's decisions you have to make of like, okay, you know, how much longer can I go that path versus a recreation, right? And, you know, at what point do you start to realize, okay, shit, I'm gonna have to totally recreate myself. I'm gonna have to begin to throttle down music and figure out, you know, a new direction.
Yeah, I knew the moment. I had a tour lined up. Okay. With an artist I was playing with, and I could just see kind of down the field, like, because I've done this type of tour so many times, I've done this same type of tour with the same artist, and I was just like, I'm on a treadmill right now. I'm not growing, I'm not moving anywhere financially, and, you know, not moving in the right direction financially. So I made a decision, I actually laid on the floor right there when I called the tour manager, and I was like, I'm not going to do this. And there's like thousands of people in this town that are like ready for that phone call. But I wanted to be in one place for, I was, you know, yeah. I was on tour for a long time. So like
a decade. Yeah.
At least, you know, a decade of most of the year being gone. And I loved it in my 20s and then half my 30s. So when I was like 35, I was like, I kind of just want to chill for a minute. And, so, you know, that's how I kind of transitioned into, you know, the real estate game. Which has been great.
Yeah.
But, you know, the grass isn't always greener. You know, I'm more financially stable, obviously. But now I want more of that creative outlet still. So it's finding that balance.
Yeah. What were the feelings when you knew you needed to transition out? What was the hardest part about it? How... Do you allow yourself to go, you know, super low? You're like, you know, you're like, hey.
I felt like I did a lot of the things I wanted to do in music.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel like, you know, I mean, like I said.
You didn't feel like you're giving up on a dream?
No, because I felt it was like the tour that I was booked, that I was ready to go on, it's like something I've done a dozen times. I already knew what the money was going to be. I knew what the cities were going to be. I knew, played all the venues. I've done.
Fuck Minneapolis.
Fuck Minneapolis. I think we played slated to play there 4 times. It was just time. You just know when it's like it's time for a change. You know, being a musician is mostly just it's a struggling like day after day after day, and I just don't want to be, you know, in my 50s living on a bus. Making $40,000 a year. That's just not the stress. The stress of trying to live like that will motivate you to like find another way.
And what's going through your head of okay, shit, I got to learn a whole new skill set. Did you know real estate was the next step? When you're starting to think that you just resign out of the tour or passing the tour.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a hard right. You know, I was getting my real estate license while I was on tour bus. I was reading the books, taking the tests. And I thought maybe I'll get the license if I want to transition. At least it'll have it and be easier to do. Real estate is by no means easier than the music business. If anything, it might be a little more difficult. It's very saturated as well. But I think it's also something you can do your whole life.
Yeah.
It can be very financially profitable. It's very difficult to make money in music. And if you do, it's usually a one-off thing for a while. You know? So.
Any fears of, will I be able to make this transition? Or is it just like, you know, I'm good. Anything I put my mind to, I fucking master it. So I'm going to master that too. Or what's kind of the, there's a bridge there, right? It's like everything you know and mm-hmm. your full identity is about to change.
Well, the identity change took years. Because everybody, first of all, for everyone to think of you as a musician and then transition to thinking of you as a, you know, somebody in the real estate business, that takes years and years and years. You know, it took me probably like 3 or 4 years for people to kind of make that change in their mind. But yeah, it's like for the first 2 or 3 years, I struggled with that because I was like, I still had one foot in music. And, you know, I still do music now. I mean,
yeah.
I'm probably going to go back on tour next year for a couple weeks. And I'd love to do like little 2-week, 3-week runs, which is perfect. So that's like a vacation for me.
Kind of like feeds the creative outlet.
You have to have the creative outlet alive still.
Because when I think of how this translates back to solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, sales professionals, it's a career change. I had a company that was so this, and now that's gone, and fuck, how do I go recreate that? Or
you have to reinvent yourself.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. So what's some of the strategies? Let's go what did you do strategically, either mentally or you know, branding or anything you did strategically to make this shift?
I made sure to find a mentor. It's like starting over from scratch with anything else.
That's great. Okay.
I found a great mentor, a great team, and someone that provided, you know, the infrastructure and support to, you know, I've been successful in one industry before, so I've proven that I could have success, right? So that I've leveraged that to get into the doors, you know, to get meetings, to get interviews. So joined probably one of the best real estate teams you can join in Los Angeles, in the country. And, you know, they gave me the opportunity. They threw me in the deep end. They, you know, I'm still with them to this day. And mentorship has always been, even with music, just having a mentor, business, you know, in life, whatever, huge. Which you talk about every single day.
Well, that's fantastic advice. I mean, you know, I think people underestimate. It's like, okay, well, I've made it to the top of this. I'm going to go get a mentor and I think there's a lot of ego in that for people. They let that stop them.
Yeah, the toughest part is like you're starting from scratch.
Yeah.
At 35 years old. It's like, well, I'm going to have to either start now or stay where I'm at. You know, so that was the toughest part.
Key ingredient, find a mentor. So what's, you got one, but you have to make this transition. New industry, new learnings, what type of work ethic, what type of discipline, or does it just come naturally to you? Like what's some of the characteristics and attributes?
The other difficult component of it is how you view yourself. Because I always, like my identity was always musician. I play guitar, I play piano. That is who I am. To, I am in real estate. I sell real estate. I'm a real estate agent. And, you know, that took a long time. And there were the years where it was like, I'm still a musician. That's just kind of like fucking around in real estate.
Yeah.
Now, 6-7 years in, it's like,
I'm in real estate. Fucking around in music.
And I fuck around in music on my spare time.
This is perfect because, you know, your story is different than other people we've had on where there's like this obvious moment of failure or obvious moment of their company is going out of business or something like that, right?
Right.
So, and I'm glad that we got here because your message and your story, it lands to a different group of people. Your fire is personal identity. And now it's starting to come out in the communication, right? So
right. It's
like, all right, wait a second. The hardest part about, you know, doing what I do now is letting go of who I once was.
Oh, it took years.
Yeah.
I mean, the first 2-3 years, people are like, so what do you do? I'm like, I'm in music. Music and real estate. Music and real estate. Now I don't even say music. I just say, this is what I do. You know, and that was tough, you know, because I felt like a part of me had to die off,
yeah,
in a sense. But now I have a different relationship with music, and it's more just personal, and I just screw around in here for myself.
And you're unbelievable.
Thank you. But I mean, I the last couple of years of music, I really did not like music. Like, you get to that point where you're just burnt out.
Yeah.
You know?
Any strategies for people of how do you begin to shift that identity? Can you think of when you reverse engineer, is it just like time, other than time, is it like you have to make some, like?
I think it's, it comes down to your daily habits. Your habits really kind of shape your identity.
Yeah.
And I think it works the other way as well. Your identity shapes your habits. So, you know, the more I started thinking to myself as, okay, I'm in real estate, what do I need to do on a daily basis to fit that profile?
Yep.
Right? So you start creating a daily structure for yourself of, you know, habits and activities that are around that. So, you know, maybe you're just going around and looking at properties, or you're making certain phone calls, you're having certain types of conversations, you're reading about real estate, you're reading real estate books, real estate podcasts. You got to really kind of like, that's the way I operate. I want it from all angles.
Immersion.
You know, immersion.
So full immersion.
Yeah, so be all in.
Great, by the way, great strategy. What you just said was, if you're going to fucking change your identity, you better go full immersion on the new identity.
Yeah.
From all the senses, eyes, ears, environment, like anything you can access.
Yeah.
Full immersion.
You know, it's more than just like changing your social media profile.
You change your LinkedIn.
So leather pants to like, you know, plaid suit.
Change your wardrobe.
Yeah.
Change your career on LinkedIn. You're good.
Yeah. And by the way, I did get into like the cheesy suits when I first started real estate, and I thought that was like the way to go. Now I just wear the same.
Back to leather pants.
No, not leather pants, but it's like, it doesn't matter.
No, like super serious question. I've been wanting to ask this for like 10 years. And I know everyone watching this wants to know, how many black t-shirts do you own?
That's like 16.
Just black t-shirts.
Yeah.
16.
Well, you got the crew neck, you got V-neck, you got low V.
We've hung out a lot.
Low V.
And I've never seen you not in a black t-shirt. 100 for 100.
Yeah, I got a couple of white t-shirts before I switch it up.
If you need any color, I've got you. But you look good in the black t-shirts.
Stick with what works.
So you actually talked about habits, because you're one of the most disciplined friends that I have. Like, you're fucking insanely disciplined. We just went on a hike together.
Yeah.
And you have a goal of running a mile to a location, Runyon Canyon, where you do a 1.2-mile hike, where you actually run half of it, and you hike the rest of it, you run the rest back down, and you run the mile back.
Yeah.
How many times is your goal to do this?
200 times this year.
200 times?
But that's on top of my like actual weight training.
No, so I know.
So it's...
I haven't gotten to that part yet.
Yeah.
I'm building up.
Yeah, so...
Hang on. You have a goal 200 times to run 2 miles with a mile hike in between.
Right.
And you've done it how many times this year?
Today was 173.
173.
Yeah.
173. Yeah. Where you told me if we drove to Runyon to save time, mm-hmm. you couldn't count it.
I couldn't count it.
So not 172.
That might be obsessive compulsiveness as well.
It's a little
obsessive compulsiveness. But I can't have that. I can't have that asterisk.
Can't have that blemish.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like Barry Bonds.
Yeah.
No asterisk.
Got to 199.
Nick made me Uber.
I'm gonna have to redo this whole thing next year.
Like, it's insane. If you were in the fitness industry, that's insane. To do that 200 times and work out as much as you do and the diet that you have, if you're in the fitness industry, it's insane. But you do that while in the real estate industry, while still playing music and having an active social
life. I just love it. I mean, I almost was like, maybe I should just be in the fitness industry. But I don't know. I've never really pursued, like,
maybe it becomes a passive investment strategy for you.
Maybe
the last guy that sat in that chair a couple hours ago had the largest organized fitness or the
yoga studio
set in flow.
Yeah,
most fun, sexiest, largest, hottest, and then COVID killed it. Maybe you two should pair off.
Yeah,
and you could actually come play music live while people.
He asked me to do that.
That'd be sick.
Before he started that company, he's already started. He's like, "Will you come play piano in the?"
That's genius.
Yeah.
You guys should. Yeah, I like it. I want a piece of the company.
Sweaty piano.
Sweaty keys.
That's great.
All right, you're an avid reader.
Ish.
Ow, bow.
Ish.
Two or three books regarding on the topic of success principles or results or for people that are watching this. A couple books that you
love. I love Meditations, Marcus Aurelius, which is a classic Stoic book.
Wow.
There's another one about, it's not written by Naval Ravikant, but it's basically a combination of, or a collection of quotes and ideas about him.
Okay.
Can't remember the name, but there's not many books on Naval Ravikant. Really enjoy that. And
say the name again.
Naval Ravikant is the guy's name.
Okay.
I'm
learning something right now. Tell me more.
Yeah, I'll show you the book after the podcast. Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth was a big book for me.
Okay.
I actually went to see him speak a couple weeks ago. That's more on the spiritual side. Yeah. I like Jordan Peterson.
I love Jordan Peterson.
So I've listened to...
He's a fucking savage.
I listened to both of his books, which is not enough. Like, listening to books is like, you know...
That's what I do.
I do it too, but if I really like what I'm listening to, I'll read the book.
Okay.
After. So I'm rereading.
Which one of the two do you like better?
I like 12 Principles.
Okay.
Yeah. But he, just listening to him will make you smarter.
He's so fucking brilliant.
Yeah. He's why I think one of the top thought leaders today.
Agreed. Sure. Agreed. Okay. Shifting a little bit out of your story and kind of rounding out the conversation. I think people underestimate what it takes, the work ethic, the drive, the habits for someone to be, you know, the top of their game as a musician. I think they overestimate the talent side of it and they underestimate the work side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and I have such respect for what you do in your daily routine. Go any direction you want. Three top tips for anyone watching this that wants to create success in their life or more or whatever, any direction you want to go.
For music specifically?
No. Just in, well, it's probably in business, right? But what I'm saying is your music habits and work ethic translated over to business.
Yeah.
Like, it's like...
Well, all my habits are, they're not huge surmountable mountains that I need to conquer every day.
There's 200 mountains.
200 mountains. But whatever it is, so if it's an exercise routine, pick something that you enjoy doing so that you will do it consistently. If it's a diet that you're choosing, like pick a diet that you're not gonna just do for 30 days. Pick something that you actually like can enjoy and do long term. So like I'm big on consistency versus like I'm not gonna go to the gym for 6 hours today. I'm gonna go for 30 minutes, but I'm gonna go for 30 minutes 6 days this week. And then take one day off.
Yep.
So it's a lot of bite-sized habits over a consistent time. So
compound effect,
and I stack. You know, I like stacking different habits. So like, if I'm going to do my cardio, And one of my other habits is that I want to listen to 30 minutes of an audiobook a day. I'll stack that.
Smart.
Right? So yeah, or if I'm like, I want to stretch 15 minutes every morning, so maybe I'll put on something to listen to that's like a podcast that I want to listen to, and I'll stack that together.
Like Forged by Fire.
Like Forged by Fire.
Duh.
Check it out. The habits always change. I believe in a morning routine. A morning routine is very important. I always like to journal. You know, I have 6 different habits that I try to hit every day.
Tell us.
So one of them is stretching, because I'm old. Meditation. Visualization, which you're big on.
Yeah.
30 minutes of an audio book or podcast, like educational podcast, not like a fucking bullshit one. And then read for 30, 45 minutes.
Nice.
Is that 6?
It's 5.
It's 5. And then what was
number 6 is journal.
No, I don't. No, because that's automatic now. So once a habit becomes automatic, I take it off the list.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
So it's like journaling is like eating. So you don't have a habit to eat. So you no longer have a habit to journal because it's
yeah.
automatic.
Yeah.
Huh.
So stretch, meditation, visualization, read, audio. There's one other. Maybe I took it off the list. If I could do 4 of the 5 in a day, then I'll consider that a win.
Do you have business habits where you're like, okay, I must do 10 outbound calls, or I must do 5 blank, or I must do...
Yes, it's more tailored to, like, I will spend 15 minutes every day reading from XYZ, like real estate websites.
Right.
Make sure I'm up to date. Read something in my field.
Sure.
For 10, 15 minutes a day. But I do have like a system of following up with prospects, and you know, I hit that every day.
Yep.
That's something I do. I do like 2 hours, 3 hours of what I call the deep work, which I could sit down here, I could answer every email, I could get back to every client, I could send all the properties out, book all the showings. Like, if I just don't fuck around, I could do all that in 2 hours.
What most people do in 6 hours, you do in 2.
Because they dilly-dally.
Yeah.
But I need to do that in 2-3 hours, because the rest of the time I'm in the car driving to these places.
Yeah.
And I can't do that.
Well, and you're doing crunches.
Yeah.
And combing your hair.
Damn, looks good today.
And buying new black t-shirts.
I need to buy some
new black t-shirts. So you need to compress down the deep work.
Yeah.
So you have time for those things.
Absolutely. I remembered my 6th habit. It's to sleep 7 to 8 hours a night.
Oh, God. Everyone's body's different. My habit would be like, do not sleep past 6 hours a night.
I feel like garbage if it's 6 hours. And that's what I've been doing for like my whole life, is like 6 hours. But now, I'm big on the sleep.
We need to get you a baby.
Like a human baby?
No, like, yeah, fucking child. If we get you a child,
yeah,
that's gone.
I thought we were going to do a dog.
You probably should start with a dog.
Start with a dog.
Yeah, you should start with a dog.
How's Stuart doing?
Stuart's getting big. He's a rambunctious asshole.
Yeah. Gotta get you a baby.
I've been there, done that. I got 2 of those t-shirts.
How much sleep you get on that?
I'm a night owl, right? So it's like, I want to work late at night. I want to do creator shit at night. I want to work out at 10 p.m. And then all of a sudden it's 1:30. I got to wake up the kids at 6:45. So it's 5 hours and 15 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, I have no kids, no dogs. I got a couple plants that I water once a week.
Are those real?
Yeah.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Well, you kept them alive. Closing thought, top tip, into the camera. Hey, here's what I recommend to you. Them
for what, just for anything in life,
to go achieve whatever it is they're chasing?
I say just, you gotta fucking take your shot, have the courage, take your shot, and you're gonna end up taking 99 shots and one of them will go in. But get used to become callous to no and rejection, and just have it just bounce off of you. And then I think everything can stem from that, if you could just be able to handle the adversity and the failures, because life is mostly just failure, 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 success.
Yes.
And then everyone thinks it's overnight, but you know, create a morning routine, create some habits that you can do every day. Don't make it so difficult that you give up after 2 or 3 days. Like, start really, really small. Whatever you want to do, like, look at the end goal, reverse engineer it down into small, tiny little chunks, and just take your shot.
You should be teaching this shit, bro.
Let's go.
That was beautiful. Where can they find you?
Instagram is _DanielDamico. My music website is DanielDamicoOfficial.com. And my real estate brokerage firm is with the Altman Brothers for $1 Million Listing. With Douglas Elliman.
Yes. If you're in LA, list with this man. This is my boy.
Thank you,
Nick. And his advice regarding rejection is sound. I have seen this man repeatedly get objected at the bar. So I'm just kidding.
Mastered it.
He doesn't care. He just keeps going. He goes from rejection to rejection to rejection. All right. This was episode 20. And it was actually a new approach for us because you're the first, what I would consider, second celebrity, but first musician that we've been able to do this with. So it's fun to try to bridge these worlds together of
Absolutely.
Success principles and entrepreneurship and business. And you know, everything you share translates over. And it's great to see you winning and succeeding while changing your identity, but also being able to stay connected to your roots and your love and your passion, which is all around us. I'm grateful for you to allow me to be a part of your life.
Thank you for having me.
Everything you do. And episode 20, that's a wrap. We'll see you on 21. Share, like, tag, get it out to the world. Daniel D'Amico. Thank you all for watching.
Thank you.